Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is David Carmone to talk about his book, Architecture and the Senses in the Italian Renaissance, The Varieties of Architectural Experience. David is professor of the history of art and architecture in the Department of Visual Arts and head of the Architectural Studies Program at Holy Cross. David, thank you for being here with me today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Brian. Appreciate it.
Now, before we begin, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I was just in terms of my background, I started off as in architecture school. I actually went to, I got an MArch. And you know, had a degree where I was planning to become a designer. But as I was in that program, I was fortunate to also begin to take courses in the history of architecture. And I had a really wonderful advisor, Christy Anderson, at Yale. She, you know, kind of hooked me on Renaissance architecture, which was something that I had never even really encountered before. So this was a kind of a indirect way into the field for me. But, you know, at that point, I kind of shifted gears, and my final project at Yale was an investigation of actually a kind of the building of a masonry vault in a 16th century French chateau. And from that, it kind of led into one thing led to another. I ended up studying, going on into the history of architecture. And now I've been working in this field for some time. And it's been, you know, it's been kind of a wonderful trajectory for me. So I'm thinking about practice, but also about history has been really an exciting combination.
Very interesting. And so right into the theme of the book. So of course, you know, most of us in the architecture field are very familiar with how the senses kind of interact with architecture. And yet there's quite a bit in the book that, you know, I've personally never thought of, and I think there's a lot more to it. So could you maybe walk us through a little bit what brought about the idea of the book, and then maybe a quick synopsis of the book itself?
Sure. The book itself was, again, a kind of fortuitous project in some ways. My previous work was on the history of archaeology. My dissertation was on ancient remains in Rome during the 15th and 16th centuries. I was studying really the history of preservation and thinking about how buildings have been treated in many different ways over time, and how we could evaluate those kinds of earlier interventions in ways that were maybe not so, harsh in the sense that we could understand potentially how they might have reasons to intervene in the way they did. And in fact, that they were also thinking about preservation perhaps in a different way than we do now. But that, again, it was really an exciting way to rethink a lot of assumptions about how, how we understand preservation to work. But then I was finishing up that book at the Canadian Center for Architecture. I was had a fellowship up in Montreal, and it was again a really kind of fortuitous or serendipitous coincidence, because I Montreal proved to be a place where all sorts of really interesting work was going on with regard to the history of the senses, that sensory kind of studies based at Concordia University. There's a kind of whole area focused on that has been driven by Constance Klassen and David House, who were the founders for the center. They were the founders of the Center for Sensory Studies at Concordia. And there had recently been an exhibition at the CCA that had been organized by Mirko Zardini, which was called The Sense of the City, an Alternate Approach to Urbanism. And so these were issues that were really very lively and exciting and dynamic. And so I was, fascinated by this and thinking about the ways that it might actually also inform my own field, the way that it could sort of make me rethink the study of the history of architecture, the history of Italian Renaissance architecture. And so I have to confess that this was actually, for me, I think many architectural students now are familiar with the idea of the senses. When I went to architecture school, there really wasn't much discussion of sensory experience. I have to say, I even came into the field from the direction of a person who was really interested in drawing and in visual representations. And we did, of course, model, and we were thinking about spatial issues, but it was really about a kind of it was a visual product, right? We were really thinking about it in terms of visual forms. And so, this was a kind of a revelation for me, in the sense that architecture is not just visual, right? That it seems so obvious that I can't believe that it was, something I hadn't thought more about. But, it was really, I was really thinking about visual experience. And so to consider these materials from this new direction kind of really blew me away. And I was really interested also to think about, the added complexity about not just, the way that architecture is a sensory, that we encounter it with all of our senses, this kind of multi-sensory experience, but that also this added complexity of the historical dimension, where we think about how people encountered buildings or spaces or urban environments how they sensed differently at another time in history, and how we might have similar sort of neurological systems, but nonetheless our cultural and historical and social kind of circumstances are so different. They shape a different kind of sensorium, right? A kind of different sensory apparatus. And that understanding, I think, was really also one of the fascinating things about this project, in thinking more about the ways that a different sort of sensory hierarchy could be brought to bear on some of these sites, how we could begin to reconstruct some of those different sensory systems from other times.
So great explanation. You mentioned the fact that, there isn't as much study on the senses as we would think in architecture school. And so it brings up an interesting point. When I was a student, I briefly touched on, and I always mispronounce this, phenomenology.
Right.
But again, I think, and in your book, you actually go into quite a bit of detail into quite some of the others. And of course, I don't want to quiz you on all of them, but you talk about empathy theory, actor network theory, ecological psychology. And so again, I don't want to, of course, quiz you on all of them, but I guess it sounds like quite a bit of the research of the book itself was also based on the study of just how do we see things.
Yes. And that, again, was one of the really exciting things for me, that this was a whole new body of research that I had never encountered. For me, it was just a really fascinating new panorama, to use a sort of visual term, but it was a new way of thinking, right? Kind of range of approaches that to bring to bear upon the study of architecture and the study of the built environment. For me, it was fantastic. And there are all these different approaches in terms of thinking about how we engage with the world. And this is really moving more in the direction of psychology, which was a field that I had very little contact with prior to this, but it was really, exciting neurological studies, right? Sort of thinking about how the neuroscience, right, which is, and sort of realizing how little we still even know, right? That neuroscientists are still kind of plumbing a lot of this information, you know, trying to understand how the synapses work, how our bodies respond, how our senses operate. So none of this is really definitive yet, but there are different modes that we can explore in terms of thinking about how to understand or how to try to gain a better understanding of the of this interaction that is so much, you know, part of our just every day, every moment that we live. And so, yeah, phenomenology was just like you were saying, it was a word that had been bandied around a lot in architecture school, and it had heard many times, and also had a hard time pronouncing this idea, right? This phenomenological sort of investigation was one that seemed somewhat pretentious and sort of and not really very productive. But you know, the more that I began to investigate it, I found it fascinating as a way to. I mean, it is simply about the idea of how we experience, right? How the phenomena, right? The in the world, but that is an approach that was that became popularized in the 1960s and the 1970s by Christian Norberg Schultz, who was a very prominent phenomenologist and who did some really interesting work in terms of thinking about how to bring history back into architecture school. Programs, right? Thinking about, I mean, history being kind of problematic with the advent of modernism. What, you know, how can we reconcile history with design? And so his approach, which was very successful and really exciting, I think, for a lot of designers as well as historians, was to suggest that, you know, the experience of historic buildings can really then, you know, we can bring not so much about the style of the building or the, you know, trying to memorize the sort of the art historical facts about the building, but really this kind of experiential dimension, which is, you know, something that we can take from those historic sites and translate into modern design issues and design concerns. And so that, that was a very successful angle. The problem, and this is what I kind of go into in the book, and was something that I found also extremely interesting to think more about, was the way that he did it there was one really interesting review of one of his works that pointed to this issue actually in a really kind of provocative way to say that Norberg Schultz's position was one that was, it sort of presumed a kind of universal experience that all of us share a very kind of uniform into, you know, at least that there's some sort of equal as or equal dimension, right? That he could say that his experience could really stand for all of us and not just in the present, but also sort of projecting back to other times, which if you begin to think about it is a really kind of a leveling effect and doesn't really get to the complexity and nuance of sensory experience and how it is shaped so much by not only individual backgrounds and interests, but also by historical circumstances. And so to try to step back from that universalizing tendency, which I think that was what really was the concern about phenomenology for historians, was the challenge of this book, and to try to recuperate in some ways this more particularized experience of people at specific times and specific places, which are distinctive to those environments and, you know, are different. I mean, that's what makes them so interesting, is that they're so different from the ways that we experience these places now. So that was sort of the, yeah. And so that was, phenomenology was one of the sort of bugbears that I had to confront in this project, but it became a really interesting and exciting dimension. And I really think, you know, to begin to think about these theories, I mean, these theories can really help you explore these aspects, which are, again, really unresolved and open-ended.
Right. And so, of course, we've been talking a lot about the very obscure and esoteric part of it. And so I'd love to kind of dial into some of the more specifics. Now, of course, we just won't have enough time to get through everything. There's a lot of great images and discussions in the book. But there's one in particular. So I've this book has a lot on all the senses that I haven't heard before. But there's one particular. I've actually never read in any book where they talk about the idea of smell. And so, I'm going to pretend I didn't read it. But you have a very good discussion on how the religious community and buildings actually utilize smell, as it is kind of the most mysterious of the five. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm really glad that you bring that up. And this is something that I've, again, it was an aspect of this book that kind of took on its own life while I was working on this, the thinking about smell as an aspect. I mean, for me, again, sort of the senses in general, other than sight, where, you know, I hadn't really dwelt upon them very much. I mean, I really had in terms of my own architectural training. And even, you know, going into the graduate school, right, into the history of architecture, I was really focused on vision. But then, you know, smell as a sense is probably the most maligned, right, of all of the senses. If we have a, you know, at least in the Western hierarchy, right, that there's a kind of a sensory hierarchy, we think of smell as the kind of disposable. I mean, if, you know, and you can ask people sometimes, you know, which sense, if you had the, you know, this is like one of those party games, like, which could you live without, right? I mean, everyone can kind of live without smell. I mean, smell, you know, it's nice, but it's not like, it's kind of, you know, it's not nearly as important as sight, for sure. And so, to think about smell was to think also about why is that that we don't value smell in our society? Why is smell kind of maybe even almost considered impolite, right? Why do we even try to sort of skirt this issue? I mean, it's considered, you know, not appropriate an inappropriate topic. And so that was a really interesting aspect for me to explore and to go back and look at this earlier material and to think about also in the Renaissance, in the Italian Renaissance, in the 15th century with Leon Battista Alberti, who's writing this big treatise, which is maybe kind of really the cornerstone, right? The De Edificatoria, which is the kind of cornerstone for modern theory, the first treatise since Vitruvius. That is an amazing mine field, like mine of materials. And he talks at length about smell. He's interested in smell and thinking about, you know, how we need to control smell. That smell is a really significant aspect of human experience, and it shapes the way that we understand the built environment and the world around us. And so he's trying very hard to impose certain kinds of boundaries upon the ways that we experience smell. And that in a way does come down to, I mean, I think that's kind of a shift we see in that. That's one of the reasons why this time period is such an interesting one to explore, that this seems to be the formation of a kind of a way of thinking about smell, which has then come down to us in the present, where we do kind of, you know, like the kitchen is supposed to be like the smelly part of the house, or right, the bathrooms. I mean, we keep those like, and they're well ventilated and far away. And, you know, you want to, you know, that all this control issue about the way that we encounter smell in even our domestic spaces is something that Alberti is very clear about. And so then to look in this chapter, which you were referring to in the book, which is about a specific site in northern Italy called Varallo, which is, it's called the Sacro Monte, which is literally the Holy Mount of Varallo. It was a pilgrimage shrine that was built in the late 15th century by the Franciscans. It was the first of a series of different shrines that were built in this kind of model, which were intended to reconstruct the Holy Land in Europe, in Italy, in a place that would be more accessible for pilgrims who are traveling, you know, who are trying to do this, you know, this kind of heroic journey of getting to the Holy Land and visiting these sites. Instead, this was more local. And so, you know, they set themselves this incredible task of trying to reconstruct, right, to somehow resurrect, right, the sites of Jerusalem, and not just of Jerusalem, but all the sites, you know, the kind of these sacred scenes, the stories of scripture, to reconstruct them in a way that pilgrims could actually inhabit them, that they could go into them, that they could, you know, be there and see it happen, and not just see it, but smell it and taste it and touch it. And, you know, the Franciscans were the ones who invented the nativity scene, right? St. Francis is supposed to have, you know, come up with that idea. And so that you could pick up the Christ child, right? That you could cradle it in your arms. We have, you know, there are texts that talk about that. And so to kiss the baby and to interact very intimately. And so this site, Varallo, beginning to look at it and thinking about all these different senses, and especially smell, was really an amazing thing, because it showed, you know, as I began to explore this material, it was clear that the Franciscans were thinking about smell in a very sort of pointed way. And that as the pilgrim moved through these chapels. They're individual chapels that are set across a very verdant, green, beautiful landscape overlooking the mountains. They would be immersed, right? They would move into this chapel and they'd be immersed in this kind of sensory experience. And then they'd leave this chapel and be out in a kind of green space that would then actually, as they came into the next chapel, right, the senses, the sensory experience would be heightened again, right? This kind of awareness of the way that our senses are, you know, after we're in a place, especially smell, we become habituated to smell. We don't recognize it anymore. We kind of don't pay attention. But moving back and forth and back and forth and back, it like constantly renewed this experience, the kind of the novelty of this experience. And so thinking of finally, you know, I talk in the book about these three particular chapels at the end of this trajectory, which you can imagine would have been kind of grueling. But they get to the, you know, the end of the story, which is, of course, the crucifixion and then the sepulchre and the body, which is laid out in this tomb. And these monks have reconstructed just like Jerusalem, right? There's this tomb that the pilgrims are supposed to bend down, right? So they have to, like, their bodies are forced into this kind of reverential position, and they enter into this dark space that is absolutely has no ventilation. And this is like the tomb of Jerusalem. We have descriptions, right, of Franciscans who were also in charge of that site and who brought people in. So they knew what they were doing, right? There was kind of, you know, these Franciscans knew what the site was like. They had experienced it in the Holy Land, and now they were rebuilding it. And so this space that is dark, that has no windows, that has no light except for artificial light, which would have been all candles and torches. And the descriptions that we have of these, you know, travelers who say that the sepulcher was a kind of a asphyxiating experience, right? Because it was filled with smoke and it was dark, or there are these flames, right? But otherwise it's like the walls are blackened and sooty, and it's very hard to stay there even for a very short amount of time because the smell is so strong and so bad.
Great. Very intense description, but a very appreciated. And so, of course, again, as I have already hinted at, there's so much more we could be talking about, but in the interest of time, I'd like to close this by asking, you know, since the book's come out, you know, what have you been working on next? What project is in your future?
Sure. I'm looking at, right now, I'm teaching a course. The first time that I've taught this course, actually, it's the first time it's been taught at this college where I teach at Holy Cross, the introduction to the environmental humanities, which has been really exciting. I mean, it's been really, really fantastic, to do this. And, you know, we've been speaking with different, we've had different visitors come to talk to us about their work, but also just, you know, reading a lot of really interesting material that has to do with, of course, the Anthropocene, and then, you know, this kind of question of the changing era that we are in, which is shaped so much by human interventions, and how the world itself is now, you know, kind of at a geological level bearing the imprint of human activity, and all this anxiety about, you know, whether, you know, the climate change and what we're doing to the world and to our environment, which is of course so pressing for so many people, you know, for me, it's really, I think it's kind of been a call to think more about what we do as, you know, thinking about the built environment, right? I mean, that the built environment is inseparable, of course, from the natural world, and what we do to the natural world, you know, perhaps the most significant way that we intervene is by building and by shaping the world around us. And those things can't be separated from each other. I think we have a tendency to kind of think of these things in opposition, that humans are, you know, these bad forces that are against nature. I mean, what we do is destroy this kind of natural world. And so this has been a challenge to kind of rethink the relationship between humans and the natural world and the way that we interact and understand the world around us. And this is where I think history, again, can be a really potentially very useful and exciting source for us to think about, because there's new work that's being done in this direction, which is thinking about how people began to examine the natural world during this time period of the 15th and the 16th centuries is sort of the beginning of natural history, and how people are chronicling and documenting examining closely the natural environment and thinking about it, you know, contemporary with these new interventions, new thinking about architecture. So my new project, sort of long way around to explain this, but it's, you know, I'm beginning to investigate this idea of how the origins of natural history in the Renaissance and how it can be tied to the origins of a kind of an architectural history that's being shaped at that time, that this kind of, these two things are parallel and intertwined, and that the way that we think about buildings that comes out from that's derived from that period is really interlinked with the way that we think about nature. And so I want to explore that further in this new book project.
Okay, I'm ready to read it someday.
Great. Well, thank you.
Well, great. I want to thank you for taking the time to speaking with me today.
Thank you again very much.
For everyone listening, the book is Architecture and the Senses in the Italian Renaissance, The Varieties of Architectural Experience. To everyone listening, thank you and have a great day.